Chapter 17. Into the Light. When I was left alone once more, I gave myself up to the enchanting sense of happiness that now possessed my being. The glorious world of nature showed itself to me in an aspect of brilliancy and beauty that could no longer be shadowed by the slightest fear or foreboding. It was a mirror in which I saw reflected the perfect mind of the divine. There was nothing to frighten or dismay me in any way. I had dimly guessed that this was possible, but I had never known it so surely until now. And now I recognize that everything is, and must be, subservient to this interior force, which exists to replenish the earth and subdue it, that nothing can hinder the accomplishment of a resolved will. As I sat by the window thinking and dreaming, I began to wonder about the nature of this last test I was to undergo. He had used the word fear. Why? Fear can arise only from cowardice, and cowardice is the offspring of weakness. From this argument it followed that my strength had not yet been tested to Aselzion's complete satisfaction, that he still thought it possible for some latent weakness of spirit on further trial to display itself, and I resolved that if that was his idea, he should be proved wrong. Nothing, I vowed, should now move me, not if all the world were arrayed in arms against me, nor should anyone hinder my advance towards the completion of my humanity in my harmony with Santorus. I have already said that there was no visible chronicle of time in the house of Aselzion, save such as was evidenced by the broadening or waning light of day. Just now I knew it was late afternoon, for the window where I sat faced west, and the sun, immediately opposite to me, was sinking in a blaze of glory. Bars of gold and purple and pale blue formed a kind of cloud gateway across the heavens, and behind this, the splendid orb shone in a halo of deep rose. Watching the royal pageantry of color on all sides, I allowed myself to go forth in spirit to meet it and absorb it. Inwardly, I place my entire being in tune with the great wave of light that opened itself over sea and land. As I did so, I found every nerve in my body thrilled with responsive ecstasy, even as harp strings may be thrilled to sound by the sweep of the wind. I rose and went out through the balcony into the garden. So light, free, and joyous was I in every movement, so entirely in unison with everything in nature, that I felt more like a disembodied spirit than a human being in a mortal body. The sunset bathed me in ruby and purple magnificence. I lifted my eyes to the heavens and murmured a prayer from my heart. Thank God for life. Thank God for love. Thank God for all that life and love can bring to me. A seagull, soaring inland, flew over my head with a little cry. Its grateful poise reminded me of the time I had passed in Morton Harlan's yacht, when I had watched these snow-white creatures dipping into the waves, then soaring up into the skies again. On a sudden impulse, I stretched out my hand, determined, if I could, to stay the bird in its flight and bring it down to me. The effort was successful. Slowly, as if checked by some obstacle that it felt but could not see, the lovely winged thing swept round and round in an ever-descending circle, finally to alight on my wrist. I held it so for a moment. It turned its head towards me, its ruby-brown eyes sparkling in the sun. I then tossed it off into the air again, allowing it again its freedom. Thereupon, after another circling swoop or two, It disappeared, and I walked on in a happy reverie, realizing that what I could do with the visible things of nature, I could do as easily with the invisible. A sense of power vibrated through me, power to command and power to resist, power that forbade all hesitation, vacillation, or uncertainty, power that, being connected by both physical and spiritual currents with this planet Earth and the atmosphere surrounding it, draws to itself all it desires and rejects all that it does not need. Returning slowly through the garden and lingering by the beds of flowers adorning it, I noticed how, as I bent over any particular blossom, it would raise its head toward me, as if drawn by a magnet. I was not inclined to gather a single one of those beautiful blossoms for my own pleasure. Some occult sympathy now existed between us, and I could no more sever a rose from its stem than I could kill a bird as it sang me its dainty little songs. On re-entering my room, I found the usual refection prepared for me, fresh fruit and bread, milk and water, the only kind of food I was allowed. It was quite sufficient for me. In fact, I had not at any time felt the sensation of hunger. I began to wonder, how long had I been a probationer in the house of Aselzion? Days? Weeks? I could not tell. I was realizing in full the truth that, with the things of the infinite, time does not exist. And I recalled the verse of the ancient psalm. 1,000 ages in thy sight are like an evening gone, short as the watch that ends the night before the rising sun. And while my thoughts ran thus, I opened the book, The Secret of Life, and read, "How truly to rule. Every man, every woman, must give of his or her best. The artist must give his noblest art, not for what it brings him personally in income or renown, but for what it does in the way of uplifting him, and for what it does for others in the way of uplifting them. The poet must give his highest thoughts, not for praise, but for love. The craftsman also must do his best, not for the coin he receives for his work, but for the fact that, by working, and by doing his best to work well, he helps himself and also others. No one should ever waste, by self-indulgence, the forces with which he has been endowed. By giving, he gains ever greater power, strength, and understanding. Indolence is waste. Selfishness leads to suffering. Only love and self-expansion by self-giving bring lasting happiness. These are the makers of life and the rulers of the universe." So far I read. Then laying my book down, I listened. Music, solemn and exquisitely beautiful, stole on my ears from far away. It seemed to float in through the open window in a double chorus, rising from the sea and falling from the heavens. Delicious harmonies trembled in the air, as soft as fine rain falling on a bed of roses. With their penetrating tenderness, 1,000 suggestions and 1,000 memories came to me, all of them infinitely sweet. I began to think that even if Rafael Santoris were by some mischance separated from me, or changed toward me in any way, it need not affect me overmuch, so long as I, in my soul, cherished my love for him. Ours was love of a higher than earthly quality. What difference could a few years more or less make, if we were bound by the eternal laws of love? The lesson of life is to love, not to be loved. The music went on, in varying moods of lovely harmony, and my mind drifted lazily, like a floating cloud above the waves of sound. I thought compassionately of the unrest and discontent of thousands who devote themselves to life's smallest and narrowest aims. People for whom the loss of a mere piece of clothing seems more dreadful than a national crisis. People who devote all their powers to schemes of self-aggrandizement. People who discuss trifles until discussion itself is worn threadbare, ears tire of listening, and brain is weary. People who, though regular churchgoers, yet treat one another unkindly, and scruple not to play the part of talebearer and mischief maker, deliberately setting out to break friendships and to destroy love. All these reflections, I say, flitted through my mind, and I thought how different this world would be if men would hold to noble ideals and allow the latent greatness within them to have its way. Such people might truly rule their own universe and prevent it from falling into chaos. How fair for them would life be, how replete with health and joy. What a paradise might be created on earth, and what a constant blessing might be drawn to the world from the Most High. Gradually, as I sat absorbed in my reveries, the afternoon waned and became twilight. Then twilight became dusk. One star, as brilliant as a diamond, flashed out suddenly above a rift of cloud, and a soft darkness began to creep stealthily over sky and sea. I moved away from the window and paced slowly up and down the room, waiting and wondering. The music continued, but had become slower and more solemn. It sounded like a great organ in a cathedral, impressing me with a sense of prayer and praise, indeed, more praise than prayer, for I had nothing for which to pray. God had become my own soul. That was enough. As darkness stole over the sky, a soft, suffused light illumined the room, and I now observed that it was the surface of the walls that shone in this delicate yet luminous manner. I put my hand on one of the walls and found it, though bright to the eyes, quite cool to the touch. It was no more fatiguing to look at, moreover, than the sunlight on a landscape. I wondered how the light was thus produced. Certainly its effect was beautiful. As I walked to and fro, enjoying the various graceful and artistic objects which adorned the room, I perceived an easel on which a picture had been placed, a curtain of dark velvet drawn across it. Moved by curiosity, I drew the curtain aside, and my heart gave a quick bound of delight. It was an admirably executed portrait of Rafael Santoris. The grave blue eyes looked into my own. A smile lighted the firm, handsome mouth. The whole picture spoke to me, seeming to ask me, "Wherefore didst thou doubt?" I stood gazing at it, enrapt for several minutes, realizing how much even the counterfeit presentment of a beloved face may mean. And then I began to think how strange it is that we never seem ready to admit the strong influence of nature on us as individual persons. Up at a vast height above the earth, and looking down upon a crowd of people from the car of a balloon or from an airplane, all human beings look the same, a black mass of tiny, moving units. Descending among them, however, we find uniqueness in every face and figure. Though all are made on the same model, no two are alike. Yet there are some who argue that, although individuality may exist, there is no uniqueness in souls. Ergo, nature thinks so little of the intelligent spirit inhabiting a mortal frame, that she limits individuality to that which will change, and cares not for that which is eternal. Such a hypothesis is, on the face of it, absurd, since it is the soul which gives individuality to the body. The individual personality of Rafael Santoris, expressed even in this painted portrait, appealed to me as being that of one whom I had loved long and tenderly. There was no strangeness in his features, but only an adorable familiarity. Long, long ago, in centuries that down the vista of time had proved scarcely days, the soul in those blue eyes had looked love into mine. I recognized their tender, half-entreating, half-commanding gaze. I knew the little fleeting, wistful smile, which said so little and yet gave so much. I felt that the striving, ambitious spirit of this man had sought mine as the help and completion to his own service to humanity, and that I had misunderstood him and turned away from him at the crucial moment when all might have been well. And I studied his picture long and earnestly, so moved by its aspect that I found myself talking to it as softly as though it had been a living being. "I wonder if we shall ever meet again," I murmured. "Will you come to me? Shall I go to you? How shall we find each other? When shall I be able to tell you that I know you now to be my true other half, the center of my life around which all other things must revolve, the mainspring of my highest thoughts and actions?" Moved by my own imaginings, I stretched out my arms to the picture, and my eyes filled with tears. A door opened quietly behind me, and I quickly turned around. Aselzion's messenger, Honorius, stood before me, and I greeted him with a smile, though my eyes were still wet. "Have you come to fetch me?" I asked. "I am ready." He inclined his head a little. "You are not quite ready," he said. And with that word he gave me a folded garment and veil. "You must attire yourself in these. I will wait for you outside." He retired and left me, and I quickly changed my own things for those which he had brought. They were easily donned, for they consisted simply of one long white robe of soft silk and a white veil which covered me from head to foot. To attire myself took only a few minutes, and when all was done I touched the bell by which I had previously summoned Aselzion. Honorius entered at once. His looks were grave and preoccupied. "If you should not return to this room," he said slowly, "is there any message, any communication you would like me to convey to your friends?" My heart gave a quick bound. Was there some actual danger in store for me? I thought for a moment, then smiled. "None," I answered. "I shall be able to attend to all such personal matters myself afterwards." Honorius looked at me, and his handsome but rather stern face was grave, even to melancholy. "Do not be too sure," he said in a low tone. "It is not my place to speak, but few pass the ordeal to which you are about to be subjected. In 10 years, only 2 have passed it. And one of these 2 was..." For answer, he pointed to the portrait of Santoris, thus confirming my instinctive hope and confidence. "I am not afraid," I said, "and I am ready to follow you now wherever you wish me to go." He made no further remark, but turning around, led the way out of the apartment. We went down many stairs and through many corridors, some of them dimly lit others scarcely lit at all. The night had now descended fully, and through one or two of the windows that we passed, I could see the dark sky, patterned with stars. We came to the domed hall where the fountain played. It was illumined by the same strange, all-penetrating light that I had noticed before. The lovely radiance played upon the spray of the fountain, making the delicate frondage of ferns and palms and the hues of flowers look like a dream of fairyland. Passing through the hall, I followed my guide down a dark, narrow passage, and then, suddenly, I found myself alone. Guided by the surging sound of organ music, I went on, and all at once saw a broad stream of light pouring out from the open door of the chapel. Without a moment's hesitation, I entered, then paused. The symbol of the cross and star flamed opposite me, and on every side, wherever I looked, there were men in white robes, with cowls thrown back on their shoulders, all standing in silent rows, watching me as I came. My heart beat quickly, my nerves thrilled, and I trembled as I walked, thankful for the veil that partially protected me from that multitude of eyes. Eyes that looked at me not unkindly, but in wonder. Eyes that mutely asked questions never to be answered. Eyes that said as plainly, as though in actual speech, "Why are you here, you, a woman? Why should you have conquered difficulties which we have still to overcome? With you, is it pride, defiance, ambition, or is it love?" I felt countless influences moving around me, the power of many brains silently cross-examining my spirit, as though I were a witness in court defending some important argument. I made up my mind not to yield to overpowering nervousness and sudden alarm, which threatened to shake me from my self-control. I fixed my eyes on the glittering symbol of the cross and star and moved slowly onward. I must have looked a strangely solitary creature, draped in white like the victim at a sacrifice, walking all alone towards those burning, darting rays of light, which enveloped the whole chapel in a flood of almost blinding splendor. The music thundered on around me, and I thought I heard voices far off singing. I could distinguish words that came falling through the music, like blossoms falling through rain. Into the light, into the heart of the fire, to the innermost core of the deathless flame I ascend, I aspire. Under me rolls the whirling earth, with the noise of a myriad wheels that run ever round and about the sun. Over me circles the splendid heaven, strewn with the stars of morn and even. And I, the queen of my soul serene, float with my rainbow wings unfurled, alone with love, 'twixt God and the world. My heart beat rapidly. Every nerve in me trembled. Yet I went on, resolutely, not allowing myself even the thought of danger. And then I saw a Celsion, transfigured into an almost supernatural beauty of aspect by the radiance bathing him in its lustrous glory. A Celsion, with outstretched hands beckoning me towards him. And as I approached him, I instinctively sank to my knees. The music suddenly died away, and there ensued a profound silence. I felt, though I could not see, that the eyes of all present were fixed upon me. And Aselzion spoke. "Rise," he said, and his voice was clear and imperative. "Not here must thou kneel. Not here must thou rest. Rise and go forward. Thou hast come far, but the way lies still farther. The gate of the last probation stands open before you. Enter, and may God guide thy steps." I rose as he commanded me, and a dazzling flash of light struck my eyes as though the heavens had opened. The blazing cross and star became suddenly severed into two separate parts, dividing asunder and disclosing what seemed to be a hall of living fire. Flames of every color burned vividly, leaping and falling without pause or cessation. It was a sort of open furnace in which surely everything must be consumed. I looked at Aselzion in silent inquiry, not in fear. And in equally silent answer, he pointed to the glowing vault. I understood, and without another moment's hesitation, I advanced towards it. As in a dream, I heard a kind of murmuring behind me, and suppressed exclamations from the students or disciples of Aselzion assembled in the chapel. But I paid no heed. My whole being was set on fulfilling this last task demanded of me. Step by step, I went on. I passed Aselzion with a smile. "Goodbye," I murmured. "We shall meet again." And then I advanced towards the leaping flames. I felt their hot breath on my cheeks. Their scorching wind lifted my hair through the folds of my veil. An idea came to me that for some cause or other, I was now to experience that change which is called death, and that by this means I would meet my beloved on the other side of life. With his name on my lips and a passionate appeal to him in my heart, I stepped into the glowing fire. As I did so, I lost sight of Aselzion, of the chapel, and of all those who had been watching my movements, and found myself surrounded on all sides by darting points of light, which, instead of scorching and withering me like a leaf blown in a storm, were like cool and fragrant showers playing over me. Amazed, I went on, and as I proceeded, I grew bolder. At one step, I was bathed in a rain of delicate rays, like sparkling diamond and topaz. At another, a lovely violet light shrouded me in its rich hues. At still another, I walked in melting azure, like the hues of a summer sky. The further I went, the deeper and more glowing was the light about me. I felt it penetrating every pore of my skin. Holding out my hands to it, I saw them transparent in the fine luminance. And presently, gaining courage, I threw back my veil and breathed in the radiance as one breathes the air. My whole body became light, and I moved as though floating rather than walking. I looked with unfatigued, undazzled eyes at the glittering flames that sparkled harmlessly about me, seeing them change to lovely shapes of flowers and leaves beneath my feet, and arching themselves above my head like the branches of shading trees. Then, all at once, down the long vista, I caught sight of a shape like that of an angel that waited for me with watchful eyes and outstretched arms. It was but a moment I saw this vision, and yet I knew what it meant, and I pressed on and on with all my soul to go forth and reach that companion of myself who stood waiting with such tender patience. The light around me now changed to waves of intense luminance, which swept over me like waves of the sea, and I allowed myself to be borne along with them, I knew not whither. All at once, I saw a vast pillar of fire, which seemed to block my way. Pausing a moment, I looked and saw the pillar break asunder and form the cross and star. I gazed upward, wondering. Its rays descending seemed to pierce my eyes, my brain, my very soul. I sprang forward, dazed and dazzled, murmuring, "Let this be the end." Someone caught me in his arms. Someone drew me to his breast, holding me there, as if I were his dearest possession in all the world. And a voice, infinitely tender, said in answer to my affirmation, "Not the end, my beloved, but endlessness, one at last, one forever, in triumph, in victory, and in perfect joy." And then I knew that I had found my love, that it was Rafael Santoros who thus held me in his close embrace, and that I had fulfilled my desire, which was to prove my faith, if not my worthiness, that I had won all I wanted in this world and the next, and that nothing could ever separate us again, one from the other. This is the deep, eternal ecstasy of a knowledge divinely shared by the very angels of God. And of such supernal happiness, nothing can be said or written. I pen these last words on the deck of the dream with my beloved sitting beside me. The sun is sinking in a glory of crimson. We are about to anchor in still waters. A rosy light flashes on our wonderful white sails, which will presently be furled, and we shall sit together, Rafael and I, watching the night draw its soft dark curtain around us, and the stars come out in the sky like diamonds embroidered on deep purple velvet. Listening to the gentle murmur of the little waves breaking into a rocky corner of the distant shore, I sigh happily. The evening, I reflect, will close on a day of perfect peace and happiness. Rafael speaks. "Our lot," he says, "is not to remain on this lovely yacht forever. Together we must work for the upliftment of mankind. Aselzion told you of his dream to bring upliftment to others. Morton Harlan, who placed himself under my care instead of Dr. Brayle's, has been cured and will live at least another 10 years. In gratitude to me, he has offered to sponsor Aselzion's project. He has bought land for a community in Scotland. My crew want to be the first to join it. So will some of Aselzion's disciples. Gradually, I believe, so many others will come that we shall have to found many other such communities. They will serve humanity everywhere as proofs that it is possible to live together in brotherhood and harmony with high and godly ideals. You and I, dearest, will live in that first community. But we shall not abandon our dream yacht. Whenever we want rest from our activity, we shall retire here and sail the seas peacefully again." More than a year has elapsed now since my probation in the house of Aselzion, and since we, my beloved and I, knelt before the Master and received his blessing on our mutual search for God. In that brief time, I have lost all my worldly friends and acquaintances who have, if I may so express it, developed toward me an attitude of both fear and anger. Fear, because what I have found, perfect love and bliss, utterly threaten their own values, and anger, because I have been so presumptuous as to reject a world they hold dear. They cannot comprehend my happiness in so great a loss. Francesca is the only exception. She joined our community last week. Meanwhile, we, Rafael and I, and those who think as we do, live radiant and happy lives, in full possession of all that makes life sweet and valuable. To us, this world is a garden of paradise, rich with beauty and delight. We live in it as part of its loveliness. We draw upon the warmth of the sunlight, the glory of its color, the songs of sweet birds, the fragrance of flowers, and the exquisite vibrations of light and air. Like the notes of a perfect chord, we attune our lives to the music of the infinite. And we know that this music will become fuller and sweeter as the seasons roll by. If people ask why there should have been any necessity to pass through the psychic ordeal Aselsion imposed on me, I reply, look at the world as men and women generally inhabit it, and state frankly whether its ways are such as to engender happiness. Look at society, look at politics, look at commerce, look at all the many schemes men labor to create for self-aggrandizement. And more than all, look at the sham of modern religion. Is that not too often no more than a blasphemy, an affront to the divine majesty? And are not many, if not all, of these mistakes against nature, these offenses against eternal law, the result of man's own influence, working in opposition to the decrees of God? The chief point of Aselsion's instruction was the test of the brain and soul against outer influences, the opposing influences of others, which is truly the chief hindrance to our spiritual progress. The cowardly fear born in us by the timid. Generally, it is the dread of what other people will say or what other people will think that holds one back from noble action. It should be thoroughly understood that in the eternal advancement of one's own soul, other people and their influences are impediments to progress. In truth, it matters not a jot what others say or think. All that matters is that the altar of one's own spirituality be kept clean, and that the dual flames of life and love burn steadfast. All opinion, all criticism become absurd before these truths, and absolutely worthless. To those who would ask me how I am able to hold and keep the treasures of life, love, and youth, which the majority of mankind are forever losing, I answer that I can say no more than I have said already, and that the lesson to be learned is contained in these pages. It is no use arguing with those whom no argument will convince, or trying to teach those who will not be taught. We, my beloved and I, and the peaceful community we have formed, prove the validity of what I have written by our own lives. If anyone should desire to know the fate of Morton Harlan's daughter and of Dr. Braille, that fate has been precisely what they themselves brought about by their way of life and action. Catherine married Dr. Braille, and they too now live a sufficiently wretched life together, she a moping, querulous invalid, and he a society physician, possessed of great wealth, and the social position wealth brings. We never meet. Our ways are now forever sundered. That of my beloved, me and those who walk with us, is the upward path to God. There is no other path. sectarian differences, and the different teachings of diverse men matter not so long as all follow that upward path. There is no other, no other at least which brings peace, contentment, love, and supernal bliss.